You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
A couple of quick queer thoughts to start this week's show. But first, I hope everyone had a great Pride. Lesbian, bi, trans, gay, pan, ace, two-spirited, NB, gender, queer, whatever your particular kind of queer looks like, feels like, sounds like, and marches like, I hope you had a great Pride month and a great Pride weekend and a big gay thank you from me to all the volunteers who were out at Pride parades and festivals over the last 4 weeks throughout June, registering queers and our allies to vote. November is coming. Second, a quick trip down memory lane, if you will indulge me. So it is the summer of 1993, and I am waiting tables at a little cafe in Seattle, Cafe Septième in pre-condo Tower Belltown. One of the other waiters comes in on his day off with his aunt and his uncle, and they sit in my section. Well, the place is so small that every table is in my section, technically, because I am the only waiter. He introduces me to them, and hey, they're from Colorado, and this is their first visit to Seattle. These days, we think of Colorado as a blue state. Legal weed, Democratic governor, gay marriage a year before the rest of the country got it. But way back then, way, way back in the early 1990s, Colorado was a red state. So red that in 1992, Colorado voters approved an amendment to the state's constitution that prevented, quote-unquote, homosexuals from bringing claims of discrimination and prevented any city, town, or county in the state, along with any mayor, county chair, or governor, from taking any action, executive or otherwise, to protect, quote-unquote, homosexuals from discrimination. Anyway, I drop the menus off at their table and make a little conversation and ask my coworkers, aunt and uncle, how they voted on Amendment 2, fully expecting that they would be among the 47% who voted against it. They were, after all, sitting in a cafe in Seattle with their not-straight nephew. They voted for it, they announced proudly. The gays were demanding special rights, they said, the very special right not to be discriminated against, and they had to shut that down. This was not the answer I expected. The owner of the cafe, Kurt, also a gay man, was behind the counter making coffee, and I ran up and talked to him for a quick second and got the okay to return to their table and tell this couple from Colorado to get out. Their waiter, gay, the owner of the cafe they were sitting in, gay, half the customers on any given day, gay, their nephew, don't know what they know, didn't say anything myself, so no latte bowls or buttermilk biscuits, Cafe Septième specialties, for you two. Get out. So you know which side I'm on in the war between the Red Hen restaurant and the Trump administration. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who lies to the American people for a living and who has stood at the White House podium and said that businesses have a right to discriminate against gay couples, she was asked to leave a restaurant in Lexington, Virginia, the Red Hen, on Saturday night because no one on the predominantly gay waitstaff wanted to serve her. This has kicked off a debate about civility and social norms, but these are extraordinary times. And as Donald Trump has demonstrated to us again and again and again, norms are for suckers. The Trump administration is literally putting babies in cages. And we have to stand up. We have to resist. We have to communicate whenever and wherever we can that we not only refuse to tolerate these immoral policies, but there will be a political and social cost for the people who carry them out or stand at podiums and lie their fucking faces off to justify these policies. So good for you, Red Hen, staffers and owners, for standing up to Sanders and the President of the United States, who says he might be too busy to sit down and answer Robert Mueller's questions, but somehow found the time to tweet out an attack on the Red Hen restaurant yesterday. Quick footnote about Amendment 2 in Colorado, overturned by the United States Supreme Court in 1996, the first in a string of pro-gay and queer rights rulings by the United States Supreme Court, majority decision written by Anthony Kennedy, who declared that Colorado could not declare gays and lesbians a stranger to its laws. Finally, and briefly, a quick word about a New York Times op-ed that ran on Saturday, the day before New York's 49th annual Pride Parade, under the unfortunate and unfortunately ridiculous headline, "Is the Pride Parade Too Gay?" In fairness to Joanne Spataro, whose opinion piece it was, she didn't write the headline. Writers don't write their headlines. And Spataro, who came out as a lesbian a few years ago, isn't suggesting that gay men should stop going to Pride or that there should be a quota. She takes issue with a lot of things, including gay men who use mask for mask on dating apps, which is really nothing new and a big improvement on quote-unquote straight acting, which you used to see in personal ads. And she slams rainbow capitalism and compulsory gayness, whatever that is. But her primary concern is that closeted people often feel isolated and unseen at Pride. We must reach out to our closeted family, she writes, and make Pride for everyone, not just for already out gay men, which I agree with. But that headline, you see this a lot around Pride, and you see it a lot in print, and you see it a lot in pixels on blogs, that gay men, good-looking white gay men, are all you see at Pride. All you see, Spataro writes, are, quote, glistening muscled men in rainbow colors with perhaps a few, quote, lesbians in trucker hats sprinkled in here and there. While the media does focus too much attention on gay men, the editors of the New York Times put one photo from Pride on the cover of Monday's paper, and it is a picture of what appears to be, two white gay men sitting in an apartment window watching the parade go by. But I actually went to Pride yesterday in New York City, and I saw people of all ages, sizes, colors, genders, orientations, and interests. It was truly a rainbow. If you went to Pride and all you saw was good-looking gay white men, muscled up, glistening, glittered, then that's all you were looking for and all you were looking at. And that's on you. Coming up on today's show, Rob Walker from the New York Times, the Workologist column, is here to help with a tricky employment issue. He's on the Micro Free Edition of the Savage Lovecast and on the Magnum Subscription Edition of the Savage Lovecast that you can subscribe to at savagelovecast.com, twice as long and no ads. Sociologist Aaron Shore is here for a What You Got segment about whether pornography really is getting more violent and more extreme. All that coming up on today's show. Hashtag open, love the players, change the game. Get ready for a new inclusive approach to social networking and modern dating. Hashtag open welcomes you as you are. Define and redefine yourself in terms that work for you. Choose your own labels or choose no labels at all. Browse solo, with a partner, or both, all from the same phone. Hashtag open needs Savage Love listeners to test their app before they come out to the rest of the world. Test now at hashtagopen.com and earn community founder status for life. Let me be me, and you can be you at hashtag open. This episode is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first order with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 25-year-old lesbian living in Minnesota, and I recently joined a CrossFit gym that I really love. Some people describe it as a queertopia, which is great. But since I've joined this gym, I've started watching what I'm eating. I'm just generally trying to be healthier. This includes not drinking, which is partly because I'm taking the bar exam at the end of July, and so I really don't have time to waste being hungover. But also I just, I'm trying to be healthier, and so I'm watching what I'm eating. And I'm having an issue where I feel like my friends don't quite understand. I'm avoiding really everything that I used to love to eat. Pizza, I'm not eating dairy, I'm not eating cheese, I'm not eating ice cream, anything that I really was the one that was like, let's go get some pizza, let's binge drink and whatever. And so I feel like whenever I try to explain what I'm doing to my friends, they don't take it seriously and they're not really hearing me. And I feel like maybe part of this is because I'm pretty butch, I'm masculine. And I think that when I explain my feelings, I either come off as abrasive or I'm not taken seriously. When I explain to them, I'm feeling kind of unsupported lately, here's my vision for myself and my life. And I worry because I don't have a large friend group. I keep, I have maybe 5 friends that I talk to on a regular basis and that I keep in contact with. And so I'm worried that I'm going to lose these 5 friends that I have, not because I'm being healthier, but because I'm feeling unsupported and unloved, I guess.
I'm curious as to what your definition of supportive is. Your diet has changed. You've made some major changes in the way you eat and your exercise routine and giving up alcohol, and congrats on all of that. Your friends haven't made those changes, may not need to make those changes, may not want to make those changes, but they still want to be your friends. So they're inviting you along for pizza, as they've always invited you along. And you can regard that as thoughtless, that they're laying temptations out in front of you, and that's inconsiderate of the changes that you're trying to make in your life, and it's not supportive. Or you can go to the fucking pizza place with your friends and order a salad. I do it. You can do it. You can also go to a bar with your friends if you're not drinking for health reasons or because alcoholism, you're just not drinking. You can go to a bar and have a club soda and lime. I barely drink anymore. I still go out for drinks with my friends, but I don't like alcohol. It gives me fucking headaches, ruins my day. 2 hours later, I get a blinding headache if I have two drinks. So I stand in the bar and I have a club soda and a lime and a pot lozenge. So I would encourage you not to be affronted each time your friends invite you out for whatever, invite you along wherever they're going. You can say to them without impugning their motives or without accusing them of being unsupportive that it's hard for you right now to be in a pizza place because you're not eating pizza. Maybe we could all go out for sushi instead. You can make an alternate suggestion, or you can tag along, order the salad, or you can tell your friends, like, right now, bar exam, working out, changing my diet, let's go do things. And you should make the call. You should issue the invite. If you're just hanging back, waiting for an invite, and this friend group of yours tends to hang out in a bar, or tends to hang out in a pizza place or a pasta place, don't wait for the invite to the place that you don't want to go, where they're all going. Invite them to join you at the beach, on a bike ride, for a hike, at the sushi place, wherever it is that you can go out to eat and you enjoy going out to eat. Show some initiative and invite your friends to that place. And it can take some time for people to adjust. When we make a radical change in our life, the way we're living, we give up drugs or alcohol, we radically change our diet, or we change our exercise routine in a major way, that is so present in our minds and is such a focus of ours, not necessarily as present in the minds of our friends or a focus of theirs. And it may take some time and some reminding for your friends to realize that they need to pick a place where there's going to be a food option for you as well, and not just the slices joint at the end of the street.
Dan, happy Father's Day. East Coast, male, straight. Talking to this girl who's really awesome. Stayed in the sky for a little while. Me and her went out. We got a little physical. Nothing crazy. Didn't kiss. Nothing like just dancing. And then we had a good long talk back at her place afterwards. Me, her, and her friend. Her friend passed out, and it was just me and her talking. So, I just got a vibe that we have potential. We talk all the time. And my problem is that I'm worried that I'm in the process of being friend-zoned. And I know there's some debate about whether the friend zone exists or not, whatever. But I'm starting to feel like we're talking all the time, but I feel like she's going to perceive me as a friend. And also my worry is that since this guy she's dating is living in a different country, it's a long-distance thing, and it's also not been, it's only been dating for 6 months, and it's long-distance. I feel like she's just kind of using me as an emotional placeholder while this guy is away, and then maybe if she decides to go live with him, she'll bounce, and then I'll be left here feeling like a fucking idiot. You know, what do I do? Like, do I play the kind of aloof card? Because it's weird. It seems like it's just a general truth that when you don't really care as much, you don't really give a lot of attention, you're just like, whatever, girls tend to be more into you. And I know it sounds like a dick move. I don't know. I don't consciously even do it myself, but a lot of times when I'm not do that, it seems like girls I'm not into will be way into me, and I'm just like, what the fuck, I'm not even giving you any signals. But it can be hard to kind of be aloof and pretend that you're not all about it when it's a girl that you're really into. It's hard to do that. Should I just continue to talk to her and just see what happens and then play my cards that way? Or B, should I maybe start being a little more aloof, a little more nonchalant, and then see if that gets her more interested, and then maybe she'll consider breaking up, even if it's a long shot, whatever, like maybe that will like prompt her. Or at least if not, let's say at least if not, here's C, is that if she ends up staying with this guy, at least this way, if I like kind of playing aloof and I'm not really caring, at least I won't get my feelings hurt because I won't have dedicated time and I won't feel stupid for have been trying to make something happen and then been a placeholder and all that.
Don't play the aloof card. How about the truth card? How about talking with this adult human like she's an adult human? You're in a relationship with somebody else. I'm attracted to you romantically and sexually. If that's not in the cards because you're with somebody else, then I'm just going to have to not be in your life the way I've been in your life because it's going to be too painful for me. It is too painful for me because I don't want a friendship with you. And so it feels dishonest to go through the motions of being your friend while you're in this relationship with somebody else. If that goes south, if you find yourself single and you're interested in me in the same way that I'm interested in you, or exploring the possibility you might be interested in me in that way, give me a call. And you say, zooming out for a second, that if you play this aloof game, that women come running. We also hear that women like to be pursued. So which is it? Women like to be pursued? Women like to run after and pursue themselves, some aloof guy? Maybe all women are different. Maybe women don't all want the same thing, and the same approach doesn't work with all women, and people should stop playing games and just be themselves and then attract the kind of person who wants to be with your authentic self, not some Potemkin village version of yourself, some fucking strategy that you deployed because you read about it on the internet. Just be you. And the fastest way and the quickest, most effective way to get who you are across to someone, to be you to them, is to tell them the fucking truth. So tell this adult that you are interested in the truth, including your fears and insecurities and why you're just going to have to pull back. But if she finds herself single and she's interested in you, Yahtzee, she should give you a call. In the meantime, you're going to get out there and explore other possibilities, date other women, and get the fuck on with your life. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by #open, the dating app serving an inclusive community for sex-positive exploration. The team at #open has been working hard getting ready for the initial beta version, and you can be part of it. Over 8,000 Savage Love listeners and hump viewers have already signed up to test #open's app. #open respects your right to privacy and puts it first. They want to make sure that you have real control over your personal data from day one. To that end, they are forming a charitable trust that will have full ownership and control of all user data, ensuring that instead of being bought and sold to advertisers and third parties, it can only be used for the community and in support of #open's mission to promote a safer, sex-positive environment for all people. They put an emphasis on women and other marginalized populations through empirically driven research and education around gender identity, sexual orientation, and relationship styles. #open is still looking for more Savage Love listeners to test their app before they come out to the rest of the world, earn community founder status for life, and don't forget that #open is donating $1 to Planned Parenthood for every new profile in their app, up to $69,000. Check out their app and make a difference at the same time. Let me be me and you be you at #open.
Hi, Dan. I'm here with my girlfriend and two of our gay friends, boys, males. And we're at this bar, and a straight dude, it's a gay bar, but a straight dude works here, and he just tried to tell us that a lot of gay men get a circumference circle tattoo on their arm to show how deep they can fist another dude. None of us believe him. None of us have heard about this, but we would really love to know if this is a thing, and if it's a new thing, if it's a young thing. We have no idea. He told us to look it up. We Googled. We did not get any results. So are gay men tattooing rings on their arms to show how deeply they can fist a dude? He also made a very big fight for gay men double fisting, which we have more questions about because none of us have run into this. So do gay men double fist?
Boy, this straight bartender sure does know a lot about gay men. Do gay men double fist? Well, sure, there are some videos out there that would seem to demonstrate that there are some fisting bottoms who can accommodate two fists at once. That is a thing that happens. Do all gay men do that? Do a lot of gay men do that? No, that is a very specialized Cirque du Soleil fist fucking kind of skill. And not everybody does that. Not everybody wants to do that or can do it. Do gay men get tattoos, circumference tattoos, a ring around their forearm showing how deep they can fist? This is how you know for sure that this bartender in the gay bar doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about, or the gay people that he works with are telling him things that aren't true to make fun of him and to tease him. Because how deep you can get your arm into someone when you're fisting them isn't about how far you can shove your arm up somebody. It's not something you're doing. It's how much of your arm they, the fisting bottom, can accommodate. So it's not like fisting bottoms look for people with the rings as far up their arms as possible because they're the best fisters in the world. Fisting bottoms enjoy getting fisted and can take as much as that individual fisting bottom can take and no more. It doesn't matter where the ring on the arm might be. All that said, I have seen a couple of guys, I have met a couple of guys who have tattooed basically rulers up their forearms, inches, all marked out, because they fist. And they'll tell you that it's fun to watch the ruler disappear and to see how many inches of their forearm they can get up a guy. But it is not universal. It is not common. It's not something, quote unquote, a lot of gay men do. And fisting, for the record, is something that lesbians do, and it's something that straight people do too, anal and vaginal. Fisting is no more exclusively a gay sex act than anal sex is. For my busy listeners, and I assume you're all busy listeners because we are all busy these days, when it comes to dinner, let Blue Apron take care of the planning and the shopping, and you take care of the cooking and the eating. You'll enjoy delicious meals like tahini chicken with crispy smashed potatoes and snow pea tomato salad, and summer vegetable gnocchi with pecorino romano cheese on the table in 30 minutes or less. With incredible ingredients and chef-designed recipes, Blue Apron lets you see what the power of food can do. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, even non-home cooks like me. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. And like I said, Blue Apron has made a home chef out of me. If they could make a home chef out of me, they can make a home chef out of anyone. Blue Apron offers three plans, a two-person meal plan, a family plan, and a wine plan. We make the family plan and then store the leftovers for later. Blue Apron is offering our listeners $30 off your first delivery. Terry and I use Blue Apron regularly, in case that wasn't already clear, and we love it. So check out this week's menu and get $30 off at blueapron.com/savage. That's blueapron.com/savage. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Hey, Dan. I'm a lady in my mid-20s in Sydney, Australia, and I just wanted to get your opinion on this stupid recurring argument that my boyfriend and I have. So we've been dating for a little over 2 years, and for nearly 4 years, I've been getting the tiniest amount of filler in my lips. I have a slightly lopsided upper lip, so it's mostly just to correct that, but also I just like the way it looks. Anyway, around 2 months into our relationship, I had them refilled and he flipped out, like, "No, you were beautiful before, like, I'm so disappointed, I didn't think you were that kind of girl." And at the time, just saying, "Excuse me, you are not entitled to dictate what I do with my face. If you don't like it, see ya." So he dropped it then, and we've had a really loving, successful, super sexy relationship ever since. But every 9 months or so, whenever I get it redone, we just jump back into this stupid circular argument where he just guilts me and then ignores me for a day or two. Anyway, it's about time to have it redone, and I'm just dreading the fight it'll bring up. Like, I really love this guy. He's a genuinely fantastic partner otherwise. Sometimes I think, fine, I'll just let it dissolve and go away. But I also don't want him feeling like all it takes is to put me down and then I'll change my mind and do what he wants. So, yes. I'd love to know your opinion.
The time for him to tap out, if this was unacceptable to him, was 2 years ago when you first went and got your lips plumped up and he objected and you guys had that fight and you told him that he could fuck the fuck off, that they were your lips and you were going to maintain them or get fillers occasionally because that's what you wanted to do with your fucking face. That he stuck around and continues to pick at you and initiate these fights and sulk when you do this thing that you made very clear to him at the beginning of the relationship that you did and would be doing on a semi-regular basis if he opted to stay with you, isn't fair. This was the price of admission that he had to pay to be with you, which was he got to roll out his objections. You told him to fuck off and stuff them, and he stuck around, which means he doesn't get to continue to complain about this or guilt you about it or make you feel terrible about it. So you need to have that, this is deal breaker territory discussion with him again. You need to say to him, we're done having this fight. I'm going to do this every 8 or 9 months or so because it's what I would like to do with my body. You've known that basically since the 8th week of our relationship. I'm done having this fight, done putting up with you pouting at me and guilting me about it. If you can't allow for this, we're done. It's over.
Hi, Dan. This is female calling with a question about going back to work. I was the victim of a violation of privacy by my former employer. After a long and difficult criminal battle, I was able to get him charged, and he is now a registered sex offender. But I now have been out of the workforce for over a year, and I've been having a hard time deciding how to discuss this with former or with future employers. I'm very proud of the justice I received, but I don't know how new bosses are going to take that. And I'm just curious, do I mention this? Do I tell them what really happened as to why I took a year off of work? I know it's not a great thing to have this gap in employment, and my confidence is down enough after the violation of my privacy. I'm just wondering, what do I tell new bosses when I am trying to get a job?
Joining me to help tackle this question, Rob Walker, who writes the Workologist column every other week in the Sunday Business section of the New York Times. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming back. We appreciate it. So getting quickly to this question, you know, she should be lauded for pursuing this, for what she did, for taking this guy on. But in a job interview, you really don't want to lead with, hey, I put my last boss in jail. Give me a job, right?
Right. Right. And I think, you know, and clearly, like, she's thinking about this kind of in the right way, and that, like, she's worried about talking about it at all. It doesn't sound like it's a topic that she's, like, super anxious to get into in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, follow that instinct, and you want to try to avoid it. I would give some thought to, you know, trying to sort of keeping in mind that, like, to her, this is this monumental thing that she just thinks it's inevitable that she's going to end up in this in-depth conversation about it. And that's not necessarily the case. You know, I think that what she wants to do is think about what is something that she can say that's relatively innocuous, that, you know, not a lie, but just as like, look, I needed to take some, you know, and try to spin it positively. Like, I've always really, you know, been all about work and everything, but I went through this one experience at my last employer that I just had to take some time off. And, you know, now I'm raring to go. Like, always sort of try to finish on the idea of something forward-looking and positive and shut the subject that way.
Now, to be clear, we both think that in a perfect world, she should be able to march into a job interview and say, my last job, my boss was a sexual predator and he needed to go to jail. And I put him there and I should put that on my fucking resume. I should be able to put that on my fucking resume as an achievement. But unfortunately, we don't live in that world. And even people, employers who think that was the right thing to do and your boss was scum, there's going to be this prejudice. This could potentially be held against you when it comes down to you and one other candidate, or you and 12 other candidates. And that's unfortunate. And it shouldn't be that way, but it is that way. And the caller's going to have to strategize around how to finesse that if she wants to get another goddamn job, unfortunately.
Right. Right. But part of my thinking here isn't just that. It's also that I don't think that she wants to be talking about this as the most interesting thing about herself, you know, in life or in her job skills. Like, I don't think she wants to be defined by it. And so she should be able to control exactly how much she wants to say about it or not say about it. And right now, and I'm kind of, you know, I'm judging a little like, talk to this person, but you hear the voice, it just doesn't sound like something that she's like super excited to be discussing with people in depth. But that's why I think it's what's important is kind of the order in which, like the way you put it before, like you don't want to lead with this. You don't want to walk into the office and say like, okay, first thing you need to know about me is I put this guy in jail. I think there's other things you want to know first. And so you start by positioning like, well, I needed to take a year off, and then kind of let it go from there. And it, the questions they ask, you can answer them, but you're kind of more in control that way.
I do hiring here at L'Estrangeur, my base in Seattle, my home paper, and I frequently look at resumes, and so, and I don't always do the math. Like, I don't always look at the start date and the end date and then start graphing or charting that out to make sure there's no gaps in employment. It may not even be an issue.
Right. That's exactly what I'm getting at, is that, like, it's much more common than you thought. Like, a lot of people take a year or two for whatever reason. It could be they had a kid or they had, you know, all kinds of things, personal things, professional things. It's just not as much a red flag. I think that people overestimate. Mm-hmm. They overthink it from their own point of view. That, like, oh my God, it's this screaming red flag that I took a year off and that's all they're going to want to talk about. Not really. And that's why you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't make it happen that way. You should go into it with your own things to say. And with someone like her, I would say, you know, you might, I often recommend this, like, practice talking, like, pick a friend or just someone you trust and practice with them a little bit about, like, try different lines that sound, that you're comfortable with, that are true, that will move the conversation hopefully in the direction that you want. Just so you're more comfortable talking about it, because job interviews can be weird.
But to frame that year, your advice as the workologist is to is to roll, you know, roll in there with something that you can say about that year that's innocuous but not deceitful. That's not, here's everything that happened, but isn't then something you get busted on later for having lied about. You didn't go to France and, and study in some business school program. You know, you don't want to actively lie, but you could obfuscate a little.
I'm saying kick it down the road a little bit, in that, like, you don't want to lead with it, and they're going to ask some questions, and it's probably the case that at some point in the process you'll want to be come relatively out with all of it, because there's nothing to be ashamed of here. It sounds very,
she was victimized.
Yeah. And I think, you know, honestly, I think that what the employer is, you know, employers being human beings, I think that what they're going to key on isn't necessarily the incident, but, like, is going to be, like, they're going to be making judgments about, is this person ready to come back to work? Mm. And I think you want to sound as much as possible like someone who's ready to come back to work, and you're not still living in that moment of, you're not reliving the last year of trauma over and over. You're ready to go. You're ready to move on. And that's easy for me to blithely say that, but that's just, you know, from the point of view of someone who's doing the hiring, that's whether they admit it or not, that's what they're going to be thinking.
Rob Walker writes the Workologist column, which appears in the Sunday business section of the New York Times every other week. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone, Rob. We so appreciate it, because this stuff, workplace stuff, getting a real job, I've never had one. It is it is above or below or beside my pay grade. I'm not sure which.
I hear you. Well, thanks very much. I love being on the show. I will tell you one thing, though. It's every week now.
Oh, congratulations. That's wonderful.
This year it moved to every week. Yeah.
Oh, so, my God. How do I not know that?
There's no Sunday Times that I won't be in, so your readers should buy all of them. Your listeners should buy all of them.
And your column is one of the reasons I read the Sunday business section of the New York Times. Business ain't my jam, but I do really enjoy your column.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. I'll do it anytime. It's always fun.
Hi, Dan. I am a 23-year-old cis gay man living in the Midwest, and I could really use your advice. I have struggled with body dysmorphia for many years now, and actually struggled with anorexia and overexercising in college. I've been treated, still see a therapist regularly for it, but the last big hurdle I have going on is how I'm attracted to guys. I'm very attracted to muscles on a guy. I enjoy watching body worship porn. My preferences on Grindr and Scruff are set for that body type. And I always ask before hooking up with a guy if it is okay for me to feel their muscles and for them to flex for me, because that's something of a prerequisite for me. While that's okay for fun hookups where there aren't a lot of deep conversations involved, it's more of an issue for my dating life. I know objectively that I'm at least average looking, kind of skinny, decent skin and haircut, but not someone with a bunch of beach selfies on Instagram. But my lingering insecurities about my appearance means I'm almost always perceiving every guy I'm attracted to as way out of my league without even trying to talk to them. And even if I do manage to get a few dates with someone, this anxiety stays with me. What's really problematic for me is that a lot of these guys like to talk about their fitness and diets, which, while very interesting, are triggering for me, especially in that context. This even extends to friendly offhand comments about slightly different haircuts I should try are just mentioning that I'm kind of skinny. I don't really know what to do here. I'm very private about my earlier struggles and don't want to start off giving a list of triggering topics and comments. I don't know how to make myself be more attracted to a broader range of guys, and I don't know how to be more comfortable around them when I do manage to get a date. Please help.
This is a simple matter of taking yes for an answer and using your words. It doesn't seem like you have any problem lining up dates with muscly guys that you find on Grindr, who must, by inference, since they're inviting you over to worship their muscles, find you attractive. In gay land, there are certainly guys who are attracted to their body doubles. Twinks who want twinks, bears who want bears, gym guys who want gym guys. But there are also, if you look around, guys who are attracted to their opposites. You will see twinks who are with big muscle bears and big muscle bears who are with twinks and gym gods who are with skinny guys, because they are attracted to that type. Because for some, it's similarities that turn them on in gay land. For others, it's contrast. So when a guy wants to keep seeing you date after date after date, three or four dates, he's into you. He's attracted to you. Attracted to you, to your face, to your haircut, to your body, as it is now. And you just have to tell yourself that over and over and over again, that the guy who is with you is attracted to you, otherwise he wouldn't be with you. Certainly wouldn't be going out with you on a second or third, or having a hookup with you a second or third or fourth time. As for the conversations about diet, exercise, haircut, appearance that you find triggering because of your history with anorexia, with body dysmorphia, you can shut that down deftly. Just if it comes up, say to them, I had a health crisis, which is true, that impacted how I look and made me kind of self-conscious about it. And just for now, these kinds of conversations, they make me uneasy. But conversations about my appearance or conversations about diet and exercise routines make me uneasy. So let's talk about other stuff. Or how about I just shut up and worship your muscles some more? You can pivot from it. And you can't be with a guy. You can't be with a guy long term. You can't date a guy who isn't going to be considerate of and sensitive to your particular issues around food, around diet, around exercise, around appearance. So don't be afraid of just putting it out there, because a guy who hears that and balks, a guy who hears that and runs, is a guy that you didn't want to be with anyway. He's just jumped out of your dating pool and did you a favor by jumping. It's the guy who you tell that to who is sensitive to it, who welcomes that, who is grateful to have that information because he likes you and doesn't want to do or say anything that might upset you or cause you to ghost on him. Yahtzee, you found the right muscle-bound guy, the sensitive, considerate, muscle-bound guy who wants to be with you, who's attracted to you, and is willing to talk about things other than his diet and exercise routine or your haircut.
Hi, Dan. I am a 24-year-old bisexual woman living in Chicago, and I am having a really bad day and kind of calling you as a form of therapy and also hoping that I hear from you and that you can help me out. I got back together kind of accidentally / not really by my choosing with my emotionally abusive ex-boyfriend almost 3 months ago. I've been saying for 3 months I need to break up with him. I am afraid of him. I feel like I can't say no to him. He knows all the buttons to push with me in terms of manipulation. And I feel like I just feel trapped. I've broken up with him once. I know I can do it again, but I fear for my safety. I don't know what to do. And my best friend, I've been lying to her saying that I broke up with this guy months ago. I haven't told anybody. I'm lying to everybody about it. And I had to cancel plans with my best friend because this ex-boyfriend wants to do something with me tonight, despite knowing I had plans with my best friend. And she's now said, basically, I don't want to be your friend anymore. So two questions, I guess. Best way to break up with somebody that you feel like is potentially physically threatening when you have no support, because I haven't told anybody and I feel like if I did, I would lose friends. And two, do I tell those friends and say, look, this is why this was happening, and try to explain myself? I just feel like I'm in this fucking horrible mess that I don't know how to get out of and I don't know if I can fix.
When someone says, I can't break up with him or less often, but it is sometimes said, her, because I fear for my safety, and then they describe this as a relationship, I like to jump in and correct them. That's not a relationship. It's a hostage situation. You fear for your safety if you should leave, and you should have an absolute right to exit any relationship at any time you wish to exit. It ain't a relationship anymore. It's a crisis. You say you have no support because you haven't told anybody. Tell people. Sometimes we watch friends go back again and again and again to people who are terrible and terrible for them and terrible to them. And we can lose our patience as our friend comes to us again and again and again with the same story, the same tale of woe. And we give them the same advice that we've given them again and again and again, which is to get the fuck away from that person permanently and forever and not be dragged back. To get the fuck away from that person once and for all. And watching a friend disregard that advice and go back to that person, sometimes we reach a point where we're like, okay, you've made your choice, which is to be with them, and I can't be your friend. I can't watch you do this to yourself. I can't be complicit. And that's how it can feel. You know, when somebody comes to you again and again and again to complain about the terrible relationship they're in and how miserable, sometimes fearful they are, and you talk them down and you help them out and you maybe get them out of the relationship a couple times and they go back, you just start to feel like you're part of an enabling process that allows them to stay in the relationship. That on some level, perhaps they're enjoying this drama and being at the center of attention. And I know that's terrible and that sounds like victim blaming, but we've seen it. I've seen it with friends. And it can take someone's friend saying, look, I am done. I am out. For someone to realize that this has to stop, that they got to get out now once and for all. And you can go to your friends who said, look, I'm done, I'm out. If you go to them and you throw yourself on their mercy, I promise you, maybe not all of them, enough of them will step up, because what they really want is you out. If you identify this problem of having gone back again and again and again and acknowledge that that was frustrating for your friends to watch and perhaps feel a party to, even your friends who've cut you off, who say that they're out, they'll come back. And then you need to make a plan. I would recommend going to womenshealth.gov and looking up leaving abusive relationship. And there is a list of tips. Identify a safe friend or friends and a safe place to go. Keep an alternative cell phone handy in case he seizes yours. Memorize phone numbers of family and friends and shelters in case you need them and your partner steals your phone. There are other very practical tips there, including going to the police and preemptively filing a restraining order. Restraining orders aren't force fields, and there are lots of people in cemeteries who had active restraining orders against them. And if you fear for your physical safety, you need to get away from this person in such a way where they cannot find you. That may mean moving home, out of state, wherever you can go, friends or family who can take you in for a while. Call in those favors and tell people this is it. This is the last time, because you are out. You are done. And then get out and be done. I'm really sorry you're in this situation. My heart goes out to you. It is difficult to exit an abusive relationship. It is hard. People outside of abusive relationships will tell themselves, why didn't you just leave? And it's not that simple. People don't leave because they're afraid to leave, that leaving will make it worse. And there are plenty of examples in the front pages of newspapers and in cemeteries all over the country where leaving indeed did make it worse, which is not a reason to stay. It is a reason to make a really good escape plan, call in the assistance of friends and family, and get away from this guy.
Hi, Dan. I'm a cis, white, hetero male that recently moved to the West Coast from the East Coast. I'm in a very loving, ethically non-monogamous relationship with a wonderful woman that is my entire universe. Moving to the West Coast, I'm effectively moving into an entirely new ecosystem in which I know practically no one. I've been using the shift in my life as an excuse to open up about my and my fiancé's non-monogamous ways, but the question has come up recently as to the workplace. Do I out myself within my office as non-monogamous? I am, at outward appearance, not someone that most people would expect practice ethical non-monogamy, which is why I feel so strongly about being open about it. I raised this question to my fiance, and she is of the belief that I should not bring this up unless absolutely necessary, and I'm inclined to agree with her about this. I feel, however, that by being open in all other aspects of myself, but holding back in the office, betrays the core concept of bringing social understanding of non-monogamy to the forefront. What do I do? Do I live my life open with no regard to how others will perceive me, or do I practice disciplined self-restraint when necessary?
Some relationships you run on a need-to-know basis, and a work relationship is definitely something that you run on a need-to-know basis. There's a lot of stigma attached to kink. People into S&M have been discriminated against. They've had their children taken away from them in custody disputes. That's a stigma that needs to be fought. If you were at work and someone just marched up to you and announced that they like to be tied up and whipped and it makes their dick really hard when that happens, you would wonder why they were telling you this thing about them that you didn't need to know. You might need to know that if you were traipsing around a BDSM festival, if you went to Folsom Street Fair and you ran into this coworker who is in the process of being tied up and whipped, then there would be a context for the sharing of that information. They wouldn't even have to share it. It would just be a fact about them that you gleaned from what you observed. In the same way, marching up to people and announcing that you're not monogamous when there's no need for them to know that, and nothing has come up in context that makes sharing that a reasonable thing to do. I agree that more people who are in open relationships or polyamorous relationships need to be out about that. I think if you really want to change the world, look at the queers, look at the gays. The first place you do that is with friends and family. You can affect the change you want to see in the world around non-monogamy by being out and open with your friends and family about being non-monogamous, about being polyamorous, about the kind of relationship that you're in. At work, maybe there'll come a time where it's relevant. If you have two partners, or if you're on Tinder and a coworker clocks you on Tinder or sees you on Tinder and says something or becomes gossip, then you can address it. I'm not on Tinder. I'm not cheating. We're in an open relationship, period, the end. And you don't have to go into it in any greater detail than that. There is social monogamy and there is sexual monogamy. A lot of people who are not sexually monogamous default, because of the assumptions people make about coupled folks, default into perceived sexual monogamy. People shouldn't make that assumption, but it's not an unreasonable assumption to make, because most coupled people are indeed monogamous. And there will be times and places in your professional relationships where you can push back against that assumption, but you have to use good judgment about when and where and how and who you tell and why you tell them. Otherwise, you're going to look like a crazy person, look like the kinkster running around the office announcing to everyone that they like to get whipped because it makes their dick hard, and people are going to wonder what the hell is wrong with him, that he feels the need to tell us. Even people who also like to get whipped and make their dicks hard, who he might be telling in the office because he doesn't know who else is kinky, you're going to wonder what the fuck is wrong with you. Same thing applies here, but to a lesser extent, because what you like to do in bed with a partner, that is almost always, except for your partners and your friends that you enjoy swapping stories with, TMI. The relationships that you have, the bonds that you form, there's a public dimension to that. It's not just what you do, it's also how you move through the world, the relationships that you have. A husband isn't just a sex partner, they also have a public role to play in your life. And if you have multiple partners, your multiple partners have public roles to play in your life, and they should be acknowledged and honored and rolled out. But in the workplace, and with friends and family, you can get out in front of that. You can be proactive and tell your mom and dad that you're in an open relationship and you and your partner are open to thirds or fourths. And so a Thanksgiving dinner at some point in the future down the road, you might be there with two girlfriends, or your girlfriend might be there with her two boyfriends, one of which would be presumably you. There may come a time when you need to roll that out at work, but I don't think you do it proactively at work. Maintain a professional demeanor. If it comes up, if there's some work function 2-3 years down the road when you have two partners where partners are invited, you can raise the subject of people at this office who have more than one partner. Is it a plus one or is it a plus partner? And then you will have effectively outed yourself at a moment where they kind of needed to know. But right now, particularly when you're brand new, they don't need to know.
Hi, I'm calling with a suggestion for the caller in episode 608, whose wife was only in the mood every couple months. I found myself in a similar situation where all of a sudden, you know, one day my libido just dropped. But I realized that once a week, or for a full week every month, I was just incredibly aroused and my libido was at a level 10. I started tracking my periods and my cycles, and turns out that every month was because I was ovulating. So then we started tracking it, and it was like clockwork. So then we knew 1 week of every month I would be incredibly aroused, and it was actually really exciting planning for it and anticipating. So I would recommend maybe start tracking your cycles, and maybe if you know when she's ovulating, you could start anticipating, and maybe she'll start noticing a little twinges here and there. Another thing you mentioned was that she goes to bed at 10 and you don't go to bed till 2. I also had that problem, and you know, and that caused a huge issue in our intimacy. And so my husband started just coming to bed with me, and we were in bed and we were talking and we were touching. And after that, a lot of times it turned into something. The final tip is your wife should definitely start practicing getting really good at blowjobs, because that was the cure. On the other days of the month where I wasn't really feeling it, started giving really good blowjobs, and now everything's perfect. So good luck.
Hi, Dan. I am just calling to publicly recognize the badass man who I often see driving up and down Harford Road in Baltimore on my commute to and from work, whose license plate on his huge truck reads ITMFA. Sir, I applaud your bold move to have the MVA print that plate for you, and I always feel a swell of pride and solidarity every time I see your truck drive by. If you ever see a tiny sky blue Prius C with a dented back bumper driving alongside you, know that we are in this fight together.
Hi, Dan. This is a comment for episode 608, where you talked about the woman who had invited the Amazon delivery driver into her home, and he had sent her a couple of inappropriate messages. I agree with what you said mostly, that no crime was committed in that interaction. But at the same time, I don't really understand your definition of sexual harassment, because getting unwanted dick pics, like, I think that is a part of sexual harassment. You don't necessarily have to say no or say stop and then the person continue in order to be sexually harassed. That puts so many women out of that category, and I just don't think you are completely right on that one.
All right. Quick correction and an apology. Sending unsolicited dick pics is not okay. It is assholery, as I called it on last week's show. It's also a form of sexual harassment, just one of the many forms of sexual harassment that women are forced to endure on a daily basis. The caller was made to feel uncomfortable and unsafe in her own home, and I didn't intend to place any blame on her. The caller also described receiving those pics as sexual assault, as a crime, and wondered whether she should go to the police. And that's kind of where I got off track and my language became imprecise. I was talking cops and crimes and criminal statutes. And while sending someone an unsolicited dick pic is sexual harassment, full stop, or not quite a full stop because I'm going to go on here, it's not criminal harassment. Perhaps it should be. Again, it is definitely sexual harassment, and I should have made that clear, and my apologies to the caller. And my thanks to all of you who called in. I don't always get everything right. No one does. But I can always count on you guys to set me right when I don't. And for any boys out there who might be confused about when to send a dick pic, we did a whole segment on the art of the solicited dick pic with Nicole Mazzeo of Pleasure Pie, an organization promoting sexual consent. And consent is always the most important ingredient. That's episode 588 of the Savage Lovecast. So again, if you are confused about when and whether and where and how to send those dick pics, go back to episode 588 and listen to my conversation with Nicole Mazzeo. All right, we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you'd like to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Hump Film Fest is touring the country. My Dirty Little Porn Film Festival. Go to humpfilmfest.com to find out when Hump is coming in and on a city near you. And of course, as always, go to itmfa.org to get some ITMFA merch and support three great organizations fighting the demonic Trump administration, Planned Parenthood, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the International Refugee Assistance Project, itmfa.org. Follow me on Twitter at @FakeDanSavage. Follow Rob Walker, the workologist from the New York Times, on Twitter at @NotRobWalker. If you like my political rantings at the top of the show, you should also check out the Blabbermouth podcast produced here at The Stranger, hosted by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eli Sanders. Me, Eli, Rich Smith, Katie Herzog, others, we discuss the news of the week and have fun doing it. Check it out. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy. We'll all be back at you next week with another installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thanks for downloading.